Kia ora koutou, welcome back to Aotearoa Unearthed, Archaeology for Everybody. In this episode, I'm talking to Lisa McKendry, who is an archaeologist from Te Rāwhiti, Gisborne. Lisa, when I talked to her, was just in the stages of finishing off her PhD from the University of Otago on archaeological textiles. And what makes Lisa so perfect for this topic is that not only does she love archaeology, but she has 30 years' experience as a weaver or kaiārāranga. Hi Lisa, thank you so much for talking to us today on Aotearoa Unearthed. To begin with, can you tell me how you got into archaeology?
Oh, kia ora, Rosemary. I got into archaeology initially as an adult, volunteering on sites here in Te Rāwhiti. And once my children left home, I went to university to become a fully fledged archaeologist. So yeah, I did it the opposite way to most people.
How did you get involved in volunteering?
I was fortunate to know an archaeologist who was a friend of a friend, and I just asked him and was lucky enough that there were sites that he was working on in the next couple of years.
It sounds like a really exciting way to get involved, and I think a lot of people who are interested in archaeology probably wish there were more opportunities.
Yes, we were just really lucky that it was a really big site that needed a lot of volunteers on the East Coast, so it was one of those rare privileged opportunities we get sometimes.
Awesome. And so once you'd done your BA, I presume, what did you do after that?
Well, my focus is archaeological textiles. So I have worked in the field, but my focus for my master's and now is looking at Māori textiles that have been fossicked or found in cave sites. And that comes from my background as a weaver. So I've also been weaving for over 30 years. I was lucky to be taught by amazing weavers from Tukumaru Bay on the East Coast, Dale Ferris and Kimihia Lewis. And yeah, thanks to them teaching me a pākehā on the East Coast over 30 years ago, it's led to an amazing profession of archaeology and textiles.
Well, it sounds like the perfect training really for working in that field, to have that real practical knowledge of how it works.
Absolutely, and especially steeped in customary knowledge as well. So it's taught the old ways. I was very, very lucky.
And I know you're just now finishing a doctorate from Otago University. So can you tell me a little bit about why you decided to do a PhD? That's quite a big commitment.
A PhD is a huge commitment. And now that I'm sort of in the last 6 months to a year of it, I understand even more what a big commitment it is. And it was something I have been thinking about for a few years because I do love researching textiles. And there's a lot of textiles in museums that weavers don't know about. So I thought it was a really good way to maybe connect weavers with some of these old material that they're not aware of. Basically, it was COVID that made me make the final decision that yes, now's the time to do the PhD since all the work had dried up in the field. And I was fortunate to have a contact who suggested this material from Banks Peninsula.
So if we start at the beginning, Lisa, what are archaeological textiles? How would you define them?
Okay, so archaeological textiles in a general sense are any item that's been made from plant or animal material. In Aotearoa, a lot of the textiles that we classify as archaeological have come from archaeological sites but were fossicked in the late 1800s, early 1900s. So they're not archaeological excavations in the sense that is done more commonly overseas.
So that's a bit of a problem, I imagine, because there might be some information missing.
Absolutely. Provenance is the biggest issue with archaeological textiles, especially because they've been fossicked. So there's no temporal association or spatial association. We don't know what was found next to what. So we look at other attributes of the archaeological textiles to try and provide information on how they were used and what materials they are made of.
And so if you were looking at one of these ethnographic collections of fossicked archaeological textiles, what type of things would you see?
Okay, what we're talking about is often they're really small fragments. So what we're looking at is to try and determine what type of material they're made of, which can be extremely difficult in New Zealand because most of the material is what we call monocots or leaf material, and they have a very similar leaf structure. So if we want to look at them by eye, it can be very difficult to tell the difference, say, between harakeke, flax, or tikoka, cabbage tree. There's a lot of work being done scientifically to improve this. However, a lot of those techniques are destructive. So it's a big issue on how to identify the materials accurately. And at the moment, we've got little attributes we look for visually. So with harakeke, often the epidermis or the upper layer peels off, but they're so degraded that that can happen to other materials as well. So it's a really tricky area to look into.
And would you be seeing things that are woven or knotted?
Okay, we see a whole range of techniques. And most of the techniques we still see today, there are some that we don't though, and that's twisted cords or plaited cords. Twisted cords, a similar term that we'd know of now is string or a strand. Plaited is often called a braid or a plait. Some collections we see kākahu fragments, so that's cloak fragments, and they're made with a whatu technique, a twining technique. And there's a whole different range of knots that are used as well.
And how do you work out what these things might have been used for, their function?
Well, a lot of the time function is so generic because cordage was just essential for everything, especially pre-European contact. And when I'm looking at a site that has been radiocarbon dated to pre-European contact, we can be really confident that we know that the materials were used for a lot of functional purposes that we'd use string for now. And one of the differences that we see in the older collections compared to what people use now is a lot of the cords, they use leaf strips to twist them together. And this makes a really strong, durable cord, much stronger than if they've extracted the fibre out. So the presence of a lot of these in older collections seems to be quite a marker that they were being used for functional items. But also amongst them, you've got your really decorative ones as well. So it's just this lovely mix. But keeping in mind that there's no real division like we have now between what's aesthetically beautiful and what's functional. Those divisions were a lot more blurred in the past. So I don't like to put those labels on too sort of firmly. Though there are some things like one collection has a very small fragment, like 10 millimetres long, and it's the starting row of what we think is a net. And we think it's the start of a net because it's exactly the same material used, it's prepared the same way, the strips are the same size, and the technique used is exactly the same as what's still used today and what's found in complete articles. So to find pieces like this in a pre-European site is just a beautiful demonstration of the continuity of some of these techniques.
That's so true. That skill and that knowledge, although maybe not all of it, is still alive and used by a lot of people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, we cannot underestimate the amount of knowledge that's been retained by our weaving communities. But at the same time, information was lost during colonisation. It was a destructive period. So I'm really hoping that some of these taonga can just contribute to the customary knowledge, to that continuum.
And actually something I did want to ask, but I don't necessarily expect you to have the answer on the spot, is across New Zealand and all the museums, how many of these ethnographic textile collections would there be? Is it very rare or are there quite a few of them around the place?
The big museums all have some sort of collection. And even though they're all faucet, we're actually quite lucky that they were recognised as being relevant back then. But it's almost like every time you start researching, oh, another museum's got a piece. Oh, the Southland Museum's got a piece, but they're closed. So the Southland Museum has feathers from this site. Canterbury Museum has feathers. Otago Museum has other taonga from the site. So a lot of them are spread out.
Oh, so even from one site, they're spread across different museums. Oh, no.
And that's largely because they were fossicked, and where the fossicker was from or his connections, that's where he put his... Yeah, so it's a bit messy.
Yeah, no, it's a catch-22, isn't it? It's not good that they were fossicked, but it's good that they were kept and...
Exactly.
...retained. So this seems a bit of an obvious question, but what kind of information can this archaeological cordage and material tell you about pre-European life for Māori?
Right. Well, it can tell you that the amount of time and effort that would have gone into accessing cordage, preparing cordage, making the cord, we can't underestimate that either. It would have been almost, I think, a continuous job looking for materials and looking after the ones that turn out to be really good quality. You would recognise that and you'd look after it.
How do you look after it? I'm just interested.
Well, just by making sure that when you harvest it in the correct way. That's sort of the main reason, is by looking after the plant, caring for it, saying the right karakias before you cut, and just treating it with respect, really. And I did actually forget your whole question, so I don't know what I was talking about then.
Oh, no, I got sidetracked too. Just about the type of things you can find out from the cordage, so perhaps when it was made or where from.
Okay. One of the reasons to identify the material of plants is it can be really useful in looking at movement across different communities. So, for example, if we find a hohere species that are restricted in different areas around Aotearoa, if we find a species, say, in Canterbury that doesn't grow there naturally, then we know that it's likely to have either been bought in from outside, whether that was through trade and exchange, whether it's through seasonal movements. You know, we can't make those determinations. But that sort of information would be really interesting and contribute to the whole archaeological knowledge of how the sites were used.
And just to add to that, when we talked previously, you told me something about harakeke, how it's a very special fibre and has some special properties.
Yes. Harakeke is the most amazing plant material, and there's no plant quite like it. And the way that the actual leaf is structured means that the upper layer and the lower layer, you can separate them off the inner fibre that's inside. And other plant materials, you can't do that, like tikoka and keke, flax overseas. You have to do what's called the retting process, where it's soaked in water for days and days, months actually, and the bacteria breaks down the outer and lower surfaces to extract the fibre. Whereas with harakeke, Māori innovated a technique to extract that fibre without the retting process. How they worked out their method of extracting it is really clever. So they obviously had spent a lot of time, I think, with the plant.
Mm. Can you share what that technique is of how they extract it?
Well, I can, though it's very hard to explain without it in front of you. But basically, the whole leaf is cut off and then a strip is taken out from the centre of the leaf, a vertical strip. So the edges and the middle is taken out. And then the leaf's turned over and a small cut is made across the leaf, just through the lowest layer of the leaf. And that cut's usually made with an obsidian flake. Then you turn it over and with a mussel shell, you just gently scrape the top of the leaf. Then you put that mussel shell into the cut, but from the top of the leaf, and push down and away. And like magic, it separates the upper and lower layers and you've just got this beautiful white inner fibre.
And how does your experience as a weaver help you study the archaeology of textiles?
Oh, it's crucial. It's absolutely crucial because I can look at a technique and I know if I've seen it before for a start, which is really helpful because it helps me confirm, okay, I'm pretty sure I know what this is. But also for things that I'm not sure of, I can try and make them because I know how to do the preparation and I've got a whole lot of different technical skills. So I can just go, okay, it looks like they've done this and I'll give it a try and see if it works. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes there's two or three different ways of doing the same things, but it helps massively in actually understanding how much information is retained in the archaeological textiles.
For our show and tell, I know you wanted to talk about a specific case study of a site that you've studied, which is Monk's Cave. So perhaps if you could start by describing where the site is, what it is, what was found there.
Okay, so Monk's Cave is in Banks Peninsula at Redcliffs. It's only 800 metres away from Marylebone Point, which most people will be aware of in that region, and archaeologists will be aware of it. So it was discovered in 1889 when they were making a new road, and basically as they cleared away some of the cliffside, a opening was revealed. This cave we know was sealed before European contact, so it is a rare site in New Zealand that is totally sealed and not been touched since then. Unfortunately, it was fossicked terribly, so we have no providence whatsoever about where any of the tonga came from spatially. There's been a lot of work done on the radiocarbon dating by Chris Jacob, which has really helped understand dating of the site. And so that's now really secure, early 14th to late 15th, based on some tonga that were dated. And as well as the fact that there's only surface finds, there is no depth. There is no stratigraphy in this cave. So we also think it was only occupied for a short time. But the tonga were bone and stone tools and lots of bird spear points, adze flakes, almost your typical pre-European type things. There was less than 30 overall, so it's a very small amount of tonga. There were also textile fragments. So that's where I came on board to have a look at the pre-European textile fragments and also to see how they could contribute to the story of Monk's Cave in general and the archaeology of that area.
So what did you find in the fragments?
Well, it's really fascinating, and it's quite a nice little site to indicate how useful and valuable it is to study archaeological fragments, because there are only 16 fragments, which you'd think that's so small. What can you learn from that? But there's five different core techniques, so different types of cords in that, which tells us a lot of information. So one of them was the one with the net that I mentioned before. So the fact that that's from a 14th century site and is still being used today, I think, is amazing. And another tonga from there was a plaited tonga. So it was a very small plait, only 60 millimetres long, that was made from hohere bark with feathers that had been put into it as well. So they would have stuck out decoratively from it. And that's really interesting because the only one other site that I've found with a similar cord, well, exactly the same, is from Moorbone Point, the site that's 800 metres down the road. So that kind of indicates there is probably some sort of connection between those sites rather than no connection, which has been a big question based on the faunal remains from the sites. There's been an argument why their faunal remains so different. And so here's another example of evidence that actually there are similarities between the sites. Then another interesting cord is what we call spiral wrapped. And the only other evidence we have of a similar cord actually from a site called Kohika in the North Island. So here's another cord showing a connection to the North Island. So there's all these different connections going on from a tiny amount of fragments. It's fascinating.
So for the digging deep section, I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about how you're sharing this knowledge that you're gathering from the archaeological textiles with current weaving practice and education.
One of my goals is to, when the material suits, make what I call toweda, which are instructive samples. And they're just a small piece that will have maybe an A4 size. And I'll just put on that all the techniques that were found from that site. So all the different type of tags that might have been on the cloaks, different twining, just so there's sort of a record of everything that's from the site to return to the hapu so that their weavers can then do what they like, but hopefully be inspired and go, well, our tūpuna were using some of these, how maybe we can integrate them as well. Some of the cordage, I'm still doing samples of them, but the visual impact's not quite the same when it's some twisted and plaited cord. And if there's something special on a belt or a different pattern, I'll do that. Yeah, and just to try and share the information, really, because I'm so privileged to access it. And it's an ongoing mahi, really, to keep extending that out to the community. And now that my PhD is nearly finished, I hope to get back to that and do a lot more of it.
Before I talked to you, I hadn't realised that there was such a big collection of people who do research in weaving and who teach it. You said that Te Wānanga Aotearoa is really growing and strong. So,
yes, the Wānanga's been absolutely fantastic. Really excited a whole lot of people, Māori and Pākehā, to fall in love with weaving. And even things like the kapahaka, it just blows my mind, the quality of what's being woven in outfits, and it's really, really exciting. I think the innovation that I see in archaeological textiles, that continuum, is it's still happening now in this modern world, and it's beautiful. And a lot of that is steeped in research. So a lot of weaving groups do go overseas and they look at tonga that have come from the area in museums and they use them for inspiration all the time.
Well, that's actually another interesting thing that I didn't even think of mentioning is that, of course, just like koi iwi, a lot of the ethnographic material was overseas.
Absolutely. And a lot of the ethnographic material, and I think like the homecoming of Te Ra recently, it just shows us the amount of material over there that we don't even have in New Zealand. Techniques and taonga like that were lost to New Zealand. So there's years of work in overseas museums for Māori textiles.
Do you think any of it will ever come back here? I guess Te Ra's come back on loan, but...
Well, we did have the Cook collection back here in Tairāwhiti. I think that was pre-COVID. And there was a huge effort to retain that, a huge effort, but it went back again. But the inspiration to the community, seeing these taonga, you just can't put a price on it. It was incredibly inspiring.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a pretty big topic beyond the scope of this podcast.
I was going to say, I don't really want to get into it.
No, neither. But no, it's good to remember that there's a lot more overseas even that we maybe don't even know about.
Oh, absolutely.
Did you want to take a question from a kid or?
Oh, look, I asked my grandson. He goes, oh, I don't know, because it's what we do all day long. He just want to know, what do you do it for?
No, that's great. So I asked you if you could have a chat to your grandson about what he'd ask you, and perhaps you could try and answer his question.
Oh, it's a very hard question to answer, apart from saying I just love it. The joy and the excitement it brings me looking at archaeological textiles is ridiculous, really. And to be able to combine my love of archaeology and weaving, and then also hopefully take it back to the communities who shared with me in the first place. It's just a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Oh, I think that's a lovely way to end. So thanks for his question. Oh, thanks, Lisa, and all the best for getting back into perhaps more weaving.
Thank you.
Well, as you can tell, I really enjoyed the interview with Lisa, and I'm so interested in that intersection of practical experience and archaeology, which is kind of that experimental archaeology, trying to work out how things were done in the past by trial and error. I think it's something I'll explore more in a future episode. Aotearoa Unearthed is a podcast jointly produced by the New Zealand Archaeology Association and Heritage New Zealand Pohiri Tonga. It's recorded and edited by me, Rosemary Baird. We have a bit of a back catalogue, so if you enjoyed this, please go and check out some of our other episodes. Ka kite!